If you have a Bible to hand in whatever version you have in front of you, or if you're following on the screen, I just want to point out our reading this morning is from the second half of 1 Corinthians chapter 15. The second half is really important because it means I'm not reading the first half. And I would encourage you, I would urge you, in the light of what I shared this morning, to go home and read the first half. Because if I read the first half, it would take me about 20 minutes, as well as the second half. And so I'm not going to read all of it, I'm just going to read the end part. But it will really help you to understand everything I'm talking about if you go home and read the first half for yourself. Is that okay? That's your homework. I will be taking a record next week. No, I won't. 1 Corinthians chapter 15. So I'm reading from verse 35 through to the end of 1 Corinthians 15. But someone may ask, how are the dead raised? What kind of body will they have? How foolish. What you sow does not come to life unless it dies. When you sow, you do not plant the body that will be, but just a seed, perhaps of wheat or of something else. But God gives it a body as he has determined, and to each kind of seed he gives its own body. All flesh is not the same. Men and women have one kind of flesh, animals have another. Birds another, and fish another. There are also heavenly bodies, and there are earthly bodies. But the splendor of the heavenly bodies is one kind, and the splendor of the earthly bodies is another. The sun has one kind of splendor, the moon another, and the stars another, and the stars differ from star in splendor. So will it be with the resurrection of the dead. The body that is sown perishable, it shall be raised imperishable. It is sown in dishonor, it is raised in glory. It is sown in weakness, it is raised in power. It is sown a natural body, it is raised a spiritual body. If there is a natural body, there is also a spiritual body. So it is written, the first man, Adam, became a living being. The last Adam, a life-giving spirit. The spiritual did not come first, but the natural. And after that, the spiritual. The first man was of the dust of the earth, the second man from heaven. As was the earthly man, so are those who are of the earth. And as is the man from heaven, so also are those who are of heaven. And just as we have borne the likeness of the earthly man, so shall we bear the likeness of the man from heaven. I declare to you, brothers and sisters, that flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of God, nor does the perishable inherit the imperishable. Listen, I tell you a mystery. We will not all sleep, but we will all be changed. In a flash, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trumpet. For the trumpet will sound, the dead will be raised imperishable, and we will be changed. For the perishable must clothe itself with the imperishable, and the mortal with immortality. When the perishable has been clothed with the imperishable, and the mortal with immortality, then the saying that is written will come true. Death has been swallowed up in victory. Where, O death, is your victory? Where, O death, is your sting? The sting of death is sin, and the power of sin is the law. But thanks be to God, he gives us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. Therefore, my dear brothers and sisters, stand firm. Let nothing move you. Always give yourselves fully to the work of the Lord, because you know that your labor in the Lord is not in vain. That's quite a passage, isn't it? That's quite a passage. So, this morning we're talking about the dead. That's a cheery thing to be thinking about on a Sunday morning, isn't it? The sun's shining, almost. And we're going to talk about the dead. And we're doing that for a reason, because we're going through the Apostles' Creed, and over the last couple of weeks we've been thinking about Jesus, the one who comes to judge, the one who comes to judge the living and the dead. But in order to understand how Jesus judges those that have died, we need to understand something about the nature of death. And so this morning, to help set the scene, I want to talk about something that is death-defying. It's a death-defying stunt that some of you probably have never had a go at. And the thing I'm thinking of this morning is bungee jumping. Anybody ever done a bungee jump? No. Anybody ever thought they might like to do a bungee jump? Yeah? Okay, I'm going to sign her up now. When would you like to... No, I'm joking. Sometime, whenever, as soon as possible. So if you were the kind of person inclined to do a bungee jump, what kind of process would you go through to do a bungee jump? Would you turn up at a bungee jump site and have a look over the bridge or whatever it is you're going to jump off, cranes they sometimes use? Are you going to just kind of, you know, rock up, look over the side and just jump? No, that's got a different name. That's not a bungee jump, that's called suicide. Yes, absolutely. So to avoid the danger of suicide when you're doing a bungee jump, there's a few things that you need to go through first. The first of those is that when you rock up at the site of a bungee jump, the first thing they want to know is what? Your weight. Yes. They're going to presume that you're fit enough to do it. You're not going to have a heart attack or any of those kind of things. Your weight. Why do they want to know your weight first?
So they can know how much line to give you.
Correct. So the rope, the amount of rope you get is measured according to your weight. Now I find it really reassuring to know that sat behind the desk with somebody with a laptop has got a spreadsheet and they're going to plug in your weight and there is going to be a calculation based on the elasticity of the rope so they know how much rope to give you. So that when you go down, whether you're over water or over land, you either don't drown or smash your head a bit like a melon would do if it fell off that kind of height. Now I'm really reassured by that. I mean, I think today health and safety has gone a bit mad, but I'm really reassured that that's one thing that health and safety has probably got right, that they need to calculate how much rope to give you, because if they give you too much, strawberry jam. Messy. What's the next thing that they need to do once they've got your weight and they've got that plugged into their laptop? What's the next thing that they are going to want to know or that they're going to want to do with you? Before they strap you up, there is something vitally important that they are going to do with you. So they're going to give you some instructions, they're going to talk you through it, but before they even get to that point, there is something that they are going to want to do.
Sign up your life insurance.
Yes. They are going to get you to sign a bit of paper that says if this goes badly wrong, it's your fault. It's not going to come back on them. It's an indemnity to make sure that you are doing it at your risk, not at their risk. That's the kind of world we live in. They want to avoid being sued. And then, once they've weighed you, once they know the risks, once they've got all that kind of insurance stuff out of the way, what's the next thing that they then do?
Strap you up.
Strap you up, yes. Who ties the knots? Not you, yes. So it's an expert. It's somebody who's tied lots of knots. Isn't that reassuring? You are putting your life in the hands of an expert knot tier. Hooray! You're not just going to rock up and you're going to go, well, what kind of knot shall I use today? I think I'll do a granny knot. Not the wisest move. You are going to put your hands in the hands of somebody who knows how to tie a knot that's not going to come undone. Whatever the circumstances, that knot is going to not come undone. There's too many knots in that sentence, weren't there? That's really reassuring, isn't it? But once they've tied the knot, what are you going to do next? Probably before you pray. What are you going to want to do to that knot?
Check it.
Absolutely. Absolutely right. Who would jump off a bridge with their life in their hands or in a piece of rope and not check the knot first? Anybody? You're going to want to, because your life depends on it. This could be the day that the knot tying chap or woman has got distracted while they're tying the knot and they haven't quite done it right. Are you going to leave that to chance? Are you going to leave that to divine intervention? I wouldn't. I'm going to want to check it. Is that knot secure? Yes. Is it going to come undone? No. Will it bear my weight? That's an open question. We'll come to that another time. And then, when everything has been prepared, when all the paperwork has been lined up, when all of their testing has been done, they will lead you to the parapet of the bridge. Or they'll open the door of the crane, and it's down to you. Your life is in your hands at that moment. Nobody's going to push you. Nobody's going to get a cattle prod and go, hey, look how far he can jump. It is down to you to decide to go. And no one else. If at that point you choose to back out, you can choose to back out. You can say, I'm really sorry, but I'm not sure I'm up for this. If you choose to go, it's down to you. You choose the moment. You choose the way. You choose the style. But it's down to you. And the reason I give that illustration this morning is because when it comes to what happens next, this is too important for any one of us to leave in the hands of somebody else. I've signed an indemnity before God this morning. What you hear and how you respond is down to you. How you jump, how you fly is down to you. Because when you stand before Jesus on the day of separation, I won't be there with you. Not in any meaningful sense. But it will be you. Being accountable, being responsible before Jesus. So I liken the process of dying to a bungee jump. Friends, I want you to be ready. I want you to know what you're letting yourself in for. And I want you to know what comes next, as far as we know. Okay? Who's not listening now? Because it's in your hands, what happens next. Okay, so when I first arrived here about 18 months ago, I visited most of you good folks and spent time with some of you and tried to understand some of the questions, some of the thoughts that you had, and tried to understand the pressing theological questions that were weighing on your minds and the things that were keeping you up at night. What were the things that you really, 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 really wanted to understand and have some kind of teaching on? And a lot of those things have been done over the course of the last 18 months. One of the things that I've not addressed directly is this topic this morning. The topic of death. Perhaps one of the most important topics we can ever look at is the topic of death. Because as you'll be aware, it's the one true statistic. One out of one dies. 100%. No escape. Sorry to be blunt. It's true. And so this is something that is felt by those of us sitting in here this morning. It's a question. It's a thought. It's a splinter at the back of our consciousness that is felt by every man and woman on the planet. And again, without trying to be personal to any individuals, when we are chronically ill, and as we get older, it's a question that becomes more and more and more and more and more pertinent, doesn't it? So, we're going to tackle it this morning. It's not a coincidence that some of the greatest preachers and Bible teachers that have given sermon series and written books and given lectures on this topic have done so in massive volumes or in lengthy lecture series, because there is a lot that we could cover, and I'm not going to cover all of it this morning. But what I'm going to do this morning is to give you a taster of some of the things that you might want to think about as we think about this question. The theology of the Old Testament is built in part on this question, and almost the entirety of the New Testament has this topic as a thread that is running through it, not least because of the resurrection of Jesus. And the question that is asked, often in an abstract and understated, slightly disengaged intellectual form of a question, we are British after all, exposes the deeper uncertainty of what many people feel. And so the question that we ask is, what will happen when I die? But the real question that most people want to know is, what will I experience? What will I actually experience in that moment of death? What's it going to be like? How's it going to feel? And what's going to happen next? And these are really, really important questions. Now, you might remember an advertising campaign a few years ago, backed by Richard Dawkins and the New Atheists. And these were on buses in London and on tube stations and billboards all around the country. And the slogan they had posted up as part of this poster campaign was, the slogan said, "There is probably no God. So stop worrying and live your life." And this slogan, this campaign, fantastically backfired. Because whilst people like the idea of not being held accountable to God, live your life, the question it put in everybody's mind is, but one day I might be held accountable. And as a result of an atheist advertising campaign, it is estimated 100,000 people in London alone found their way to churches and alpha courses and all that kind of stuff. Yes! Get in there! So I reckon we should see more advertising campaigns paid for by atheists. Result! It's good for the kingdom! The problem for the new atheists is this. The older we get, the more urgent this question becomes. The more important this question becomes. And so the question they thought they were raising about the existence of God backfired. Because it made people think about God and what comes next. About 5 years ago, nearly 90% of respondents to quite a wide survey, about 150,000 people, nearly 90% of respondents to this survey said that they thought that there must be something beyond death. There must be something beyond death. 25% of the people in the survey consider themselves atheists. Atheists are concerned about what comes next, as much as we are concerned about what comes next. The problem is not that we don't think that there is something after death. Most people accept that there is something after death. The problem is that we are no longer sure what that something is, or what it will be like, or how we might get there. And I'm going to be honest. The way that the church, over the last couple of hundred years, has addressed that question does not help most people today. It confuses the life out of them. Thank you. You see what I did there? So I chose this reading today because Paul is being completely practical and completely straightforward. He's avoiding all the hyperbole of John in Revelation or some of the more mysterious parables of Jesus. Paul is addressing a question that has been raised by the people in Corinth. They need to know the answer. And Paul just bosh, straight, here it is. No messing around. This is what you need to know. You plant a seed in the ground and it changes to become a plant. Why? Because it dies. The seed has to die for the plant to grow. The seed has to die. It has to change for the plant to grow. So let's get some first things first straight. First things first, we're born, aren't we, into a physical body. Anybody here not have a physical body? I've got a few suggestions, but I'm not going to be personal. We are born into a physical body. All that we can remember or know is from within the frame of our natural body, this body of flesh and blood. And in that outer casing, that flesh and blood body, our personality resides. And our sense of spiritual identity takes root. And hopefully flourishes. With me so far? Anybody have a problem with physical bodies? Well, yes. Oh, don't I have a problem? No, that's not what I meant. We're all in physical bodies. But the physical bodies that we have cannot and will not inhabit heaven. The physical body that we have cannot and will not inhabit heaven. That's the bottom line. The seed has to die in order for the plant to grow. Our physical body will not, cannot enter into heaven. It has to die. In order that our spiritual life, our true spiritual identity, our true spiritual body can emerge and grow. Anybody not with me at the moment? Okay. There is something recognizable about our spiritual body. There is something recognizable, and yet there is also something unrecognizable about our spiritual body. We will be changed. We can look at an acorn and we can say that's going to grow into an oak tree, given the right conditions, can't we? But we don't really see the nature of an oak tree from an acorn. We go, this has got it's got a tough shell, so maybe this is going to be a tough tree when it grows. But we wouldn't presume to know from an acorn that the oak is going to have a particular kind of leaf, or that the wood's going to be a particular kind of grain, would we? We can't presume one from the other. But we know from experience that when the acorn goes in the ground, under the right conditions, that an oak tree will grow. And given the natural lifespan of an oak, it's going to take 300 years, give or take, to grow. It's going to take 300 years to live as a mature plant, a tree, and it's going to take about 300 years to die and to rot away. We know that because we've recorded it. As good scientists, we've studied these things, and we know that one leads to the other. And we look at the potential that there is in an acorn and we go, wow, under the right conditions, that is going to live for 900 years. Anybody want to live for 900 years? No, I agree. I think that's far too long. But we can see the potential in the acorn. But we can't see what's going to come next. So it is with our physical bodies. We are the acorn. Friends, you wonder why some of us are a bit hard-edged and, you know, a bit tough on the outside? It's because we're acorns. We are acorns. We are the potential to become a spiritual oak. But we can't become the spiritual oak that we potentially will become whilst we inhabit this body. The acorn has to die. It has to be transformed. It has to be consumed as the energy for the sapling that becomes the oak tree. And so there's something both identifiable but something unidentifiable in the spiritual body that we will have. It will resemble, in some ways, our physical identity, but will be shaped more by our personality and our spiritual identity. After his resurrection, Jesus was not identifiable by people who had spent a long time with him. He wasn't identifiable by his disciples on the Lake of Galilee. They were thinking, who's that nutter waving at us and saying, bring in the fish from the other side of the boat? There are no fish the other side of the boat. Oh, look, there's loads. That must be Jesus. He wasn't identifiable by the disciples who he walked with for the, roughly speaking, 12 miles from Jerusalem to the village of Emmaus. And it's only when he broke the bread that they went, "Ah, we've seen this done before. That must be oh, where's he gone?" He wasn't recognisable by Mary Magdalene. People who knew Jesus really, really well. Do you ever walk through town sometimes and you kind of go, "Oh yeah, I know you. I can't think where I know you from, but we met once about 15 years ago and oh, hi, how are you doing? And yeah, we haven't caught up." Do you ever get those kind of encounters where you see somebody you've not seen for a long time? Yeah? There's something recognisable about them? Yeah? Would you have the same experience if you've lived alongside somebody for a year or two or three? Would you walk past one of your kids in the street and not recognise them? Oh yeah, okay, so Paul's nodding at this point. We'll accept Paul would do that. When we know somebody really well, we recognise them. We recognise them by their physical features. We recognise them by their personality. And we recognise them by their spirit. And yet somehow all of those things were not recognisable to those that knew Jesus really well. There is something unrecognisable in our spiritual body. We will be changed. We will not be the same. And here's the next thing to think about. Can a spirit, soul, person ever be destroyed? Because that's what so many people actually fear. That once we die, we come into the presence of Jesus and we're separated on the day of separation. Do you fear that somehow you're going to be judged unworthy and sent away to destruction? There are those who look to Scripture and they think, yes, Scripture teaches that there will be a great destruction, and so people will be destroyed, their spirits will be destroyed. Some theologians will write that after the day of separation, when the wheat and chaff are separated by Jesus, that the chaff will be annihilated. It will no longer exist like chaff burned in the fire. I'm not sure, having studied this in great detail, that I agree with all their thinking. Jesus clearly teaches that those separated will be cast out. That there will be deep grieving for what they've lost, wailing, gnashing of teeth. But as ever, the original Greek can be twisted in English to suggest things that are not there in the original languages. The original texts talk about separation and grief. They don't talk about destruction. What about those who are separated? Will they be tormented? Are they going to be a place where they're going to be persecuted? We've all seen the pictures from Dante, and we've seen the picture of devils with horns and pointy sticks poking people and tormenting them and toasting them over fire, spit roasting in heaven. At least it'd be warm, give it that. The teachings about hell as a place of torment and fire and all that kind of stuff are in part rooted in Jesus' teaching. So we need to take these pictures seriously. We need to take that question seriously. He speaks about those separated being thrown into the fire of Gehenna. Did he mean what we often think that it means? Probably not. Gehenna was the rubbish pit outside Jerusalem where the refuse of the city was thrown and burned. It's a place where executed criminals, those crucified, were also thrown to be burned on the fires rather than given a burial in a tomb. Crucifixion was reserved as a punishment for the worst kinds of criminals. Murderers, rapists, armed robbers, seditionists, traitors, those kind of people. People who showed complete disregard for God's law. And it reads to me that Jesus is teaching that those who flagrantly flout, that nearly become fragrantly flout, I meant flagrantly flout God's laws, will be executed and their bodies burned in the rubbish pit. Here and now. Not as some kind of existential threat to our spirit for the future. We do not need to fear in the afterlife that we will be discarded and thrown on the rubbish pit to be burned forever. I think that's a misreading of scripture and a misrepresentation from the Middle Ages. You see, there is nowhere in scripture that Jesus takes the view that a person's soul, a person's spirit can be destroyed. Instead, Jesus teaches that a soul exists for eternity. Those whom God has created, he does not destroy, but wants them to be with him for eternity. Every person ever made, every person who's ever lived, every person who will ever live, is held in the mind of a creator God. That's where they begin. And whilst we process that thought, I just want to flip our thought into another place, which is to ask the question, when is a spirit, a soul, created? When do we begin to exist? And what does that mean for our eternal destination? Jesus, we take the example of Jesus. Jesus, or at least the spirit of Jesus, was in existence at the formation of the physical world. Billions of years, unless you're a short earth person, 4,000 years ago, billions of years ago, from my reading of things, when the world was created, Jesus was in existence. The spirit of Jesus was brooding with the spirit of the Father and the spirit of the Son. The spirit of Jesus was in existence billions of years before Jesus walked on the earth. So when was our spirit created? When did God first make that spiritual reality that became you and me in the flesh? Was it when you were conceived in your mother's womb? At some point during your gestation? At your physical birth? Maybe some of us feel we're still waiting. Or maybe it was before then. Maybe we've existed in a spiritual sense like Jesus since the beginning of time. From the moment that God conceived the possibility of you or me. Now we can only know. I've never had a dog fall asleep on me before. That's really good. That's a new one for me. Chalk that one up. Ching. We only know what we experience in our body, don't we? We think of our existence as being within the frame of this shell. But what I'm trying to suggest to us this morning is that we've been in existence since the moment God first thought of you. That we have been in existence as a spiritual idea for millennia. For millennia. You're not an accident. You're not a mistake. You're not just the coming together of an egg and all of that kind of stuff. It's not an accident. You were created in the mind of God when he first thought of the creation of the world. You are here for a reason. You are here for a purpose. You are here because you were intended to be here. Does that encourage you? Does that help put things in perspective? I think that's just an awesome thought. I just think that's an incredible piece of realization. We talk about God's love. God has loved you for millennia. Not just for 50, 60, 70, 80, however many years. I'm not stopping at 90 or anything. Any other reason I ran out of numbers. You have been loved since the beginning of what we understand as time. You have been held in the mind of God since the beginning of time itself. You are not here by accident, or by the will of man or woman. And at the right moment, the moment ordained by God himself, we were given flesh and blood. Now, what I'm talking about this morning is not just an abstract or a theoretical question. What I'm talking about this morning really, really, really matters in the lives of men and women, young people and old people. You see, we live in bodies that experience what we feel to be the passing of time, don't we? We become a child, we grow up, we enter adulthood, we enter midlife, we enter old age. There is a sense that time passes, and we place all of our thoughts about life into the context of time. But we need to recognize, as we think about the nature of life and the nature of death, that time is the way that humanity has tried to understand the biological processes that impinge upon us. Time is something we've created to help us have a language to talk about something that passes or appears to be passing. But God is outside of time. God is outside of time. God saw the world from the moment of creation to the moment of its death as one moment. God knew you before you were born. He knew you as you grew up. He's known you every moment of your life, and he will know you for eternity. And it is as one moment to him. God knows the things that you've done and the things that you plan to do, and he knows the consequences of those things, all as one moment. Because he sees it all in that one moment. Time is not something that binds God's perspective. And so he knows the entirety of our lives, all the good and all the bad, from before one of those moments came to be lived in a physical way. So we get a sense of the power, the awesomeness, the size, the scale, the scope of God's knowledge. It's just mind-blowing, isn't it? Anybody already feeling overwhelmed by too many mind-blowing things this morning? Anybody going to go home and have a lie down? Me, probably. So we need to think about life, and we need to think about death from God's point of view, not from our point of view. God is the God of yesterday, today, and forever, because God operates in all of these places at the same time. And this is the mystery to which Paul alludes in this passage. That sense that there is a spiritual you that has always existed before your body was created. Yes, we now inhabit that physical body. Yes, we now have the constraints upon us that physical body gives us. We now have the problems that physical body gives us because we get sidetracked by sensations, the things that we touch, the things that we experience, the things that we feel, and all of those things crowd in on our sense of who we are. And somewhere within the midst of all that life that we live, there is this thing, this nugget, this seed, calling to each one of us from within, which is our spirit, which is saying, recognize me. Discover me. Find me. And as you find me, so it can grow. And what was designed to be imperishable begins not at some future point when we die, but begins here and now. Because it's already in existence. from before we were born. But we shut it out, don't we? With all the things, all the pressures, all the competing voices there are in our lives, all those things that are churning in our heads and in our emotions. And they crowd out that spiritual voice that's saying, nurture me. Nurture me. Let me grow. Let me become strong. Find your spiritual body within. And now. And not just expecting that for the future. And then there comes a point in our physical life where the energy runs out. The struggle with our body is overcome. We call that moment death. So what happens at that point? Well, I want to give you good news this morning. And the good news is simply this. The moment we die, we will encounter Jesus. The moment we die, we will be with Jesus. The next thing our spiritual essence, our spiritual body will know, will be the presence of Jesus. I want us to put out of our heads this morning, pearly gates. Don't exist. I want you to put out of your heads this morning a great big book and St. Peter standing by a gate that doesn't exist and going, yep, yep, oh no. Doesn't exist. Not in that sense. There may well be a tunnel of light into which our spirit is surrendered as our final breath is taken, as our final heartbeat reverberates around our body. But what we know next is the presence of Jesus. And the day of separation. Some kind of waiting area? Absolutely not. Some kind of place of torment or testing? Absolutely not. Breath? Death? Jesus. You see, Jesus is also outside of time. Just as the Father has known us all our lives, so Jesus has known us all our lives too, both spiritually and physically. And all Jesus wants to know is whether we recognize him, whether we acknowledge and recognize the Father. Sounds really simple, doesn't it? Sounds incredibly simple. Bible Theology 101. It is. That simple. Anybody expect to pass a test? No? No tests. All Jesus is going to ask is, do you know me? Does your spiritual identity, does your spiritual body, does your spiritual essence recognize me? And do I, Jesus, recognize you? In other words, have we walked together, spirit and spirit? Have we grown together, spirit and spirit? That's all he wants to know. That's it. So the question that I need to ask this morning is pretty obvious, isn't it? Do we know him? Do we know the Spirit of Jesus? Have we been in that place where our spirit has responded to the Spirit of Jesus? There has been that connection, that moment, that sense of Jesus being with us. Is that something that you know? Not know, as in a thing up here, but know, in here, that you felt. Because if you felt it, I can absolutely reassure you. Breath. Death. Jesus. There's no question. Scripture is completely clear on that fact. Breath. death, Jesus. As Paul writes, to live is Christ. To die is gain. In one, we get a sense. In the other, we get the immediate presence. All that we've longed for. All that we've desired. All of that mystery. In that moment. Bosh. There. What we experience now is a foretaste. It's a glimmer. It's a hint. Then. Bosh. In its magnificence. No ifs, no buts, no doubts. So if your answer this morning is yes, then when the time comes, we can close our eyes. We can surrender our bodies and we can find ourselves in His presence, in peace. Does that reassure you? Does that reassure you? Is that what you wanted to know? And if that is your experience, then I want to point you this morning to the key text, which I think is verse 58. Verse 58 just says this. Stand firm. Stand firm. Stand firm in that knowledge, even when you go through trials and difficulties, as I'm sure many of us will. Stand firm in that knowledge. Don't let anybody take that knowledge away from you. Don't let anybody take that hope away from you. Let anybody take that peace away from you. Stand firm. Know that what you know in your heart is to be true. That Jesus has been with you for eternity. Jesus is with you in this moment, and Jesus will be with you in all eternity to come. You are secure. You are secure if that is your experience. No ifs, no buts. Security. Total security. Who's feeling secure this morning? Don't have to put your hand up. Who's feeling secure this morning? If you wanted further reassurance, then the second part of verse 58 is also helpful. Always give yourselves fully to the work of the Lord. This verse was written for those that won't accept things at face value and who are workaholics, who I think Paul was one of these. But I want you to remember this. Whilst we work out our salvation, works are no substitute for presence. But as James reminds us, presence without works is equally dead. We don't do what we do in order to earn something. We do what we do because we recognise His work, His calling, His presence within us. And it's that that motivates us and inspires us to do the things that we do in this life. So I want you to be reassured and I want you to be encouraged. But I want to say something. If you're in a place this morning where you say in your heart, you know it's true, that you don't yet know Him. The day's coming. The hour is nearer. A decision needs to be made. There is work to do. It is not God's will that you should reach the end without knowing. It is His will that you should know. And so I want to urge you, do all that you can. In every way that is possible, don't waste a single moment or a single breath, but pursue Jesus and find His presence. If that's something that you're struggling with, then I'll make myself available to you. I would love to help you to know that, to find that, to have that reassurance. It will require a bit of honesty on your part and a bit of humility on your part to come and talk to me. It may be that you want to do that another way. That's absolutely fine. I just want to remind you that I signed a waiver. This is a bungee jump that you need to undertake. This is a jump that you need to make that I can't make for you. And I've signed the waiver that says, over to you. Friends, the spiritual quest for Jesus is a bit like a spiritual bungee jump. Some of us are absolutely petrified of taking the leap. Some of us feel like we leapt a long time ago. It doesn't matter when, it doesn't matter how, it doesn't even matter if we bash our heads on the ground and land all awkwardly, so long as we've jumped. Jesus is waiting at the bottom. He wants to see you. Hopefully, with a face of exhilaration and joy. But he'll accept fear and trembling. The fact is, Jesus is waiting. Jesus is wanting. Jesus is desperate enough to give his life on a cross that you might know and have peace. And I hope that you've heard something of his offer to you this morning. He is longing for you. Will you know him? I appreciate there's a lot to process there. I've probably asked more deep questions in one sermon than in the last year and a half. And I've asked a lot of deep questions in the last year and a half. There's no time limit to my offer. If you take that away this week and ponder it and you think, yep, I need to talk to somebody like Danny, then give me a call. If that's the week after or in a month's time, in 6 months' time, it's down to you. Only you can jump when you're ready. I'm not going to push you. But when the time is right, you need to jump, don't you? If you want that assurance. If you want that outcome.